This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Mab Segrist is the descendant of Confederate veterans and members of the Ku Klux Klan. She was raised in Tuskegee, Alabama, where her father fought to save segregated schools. Mab left Alabama to attend Duke University, and that was the start of a decades-long career as a social activist fighting racism and intolerance. She would use her family history and years of activism to write Memoir of a Race Traitor, Fighting Racism in the American South, which became a classic text on white anti-racism. In celebration of its 25th year, the book has been reissued at a time when white supremacist violence is surging. Mab Segrist is a professor emeritus of gender and women's studies at Connecticut College. She has a number of speaking dates coming up, and she joins us now. Welcome to North Carolina and the
Very
show.
Glad to be here, Frank.
Your memoir really centers, and I think one of the most notable features of the memoir is the way in which you integrate your family's history and your personal history with this struggle that has been your career. So take us back to Tuskegee and your family.
Okay. I mean, it's a book really that moves in three different sections. One, the apartheid world of my Alabama childhood. The second, a kind of coming-of-age narrative when I come to North Carolina and am able to take up struggles against Klan and Nazi violence that I didn't have the tools for when I was quite young. And then at 70, half a lifetime labor, a lifetime later, really, coming back out with the book. So Tuskegee, born in 1949 in Tuskegee, Alabama. It was during my lifetime there. Had the largest percentage of black people of any county in the United States. Tuskegee Institute was there and other things, too. And by 54, 55, the civil rights movement had erupted. By the 1960s, it literally kind of came to my front yard when the schools desegregated. George Wallace was stirring everything up. And as a kid whose eyes were pretty open, my pictures from those eras show a kind of penetrating gaze at the culture. Mm-hmm. There was a lot to try to figure out, and the civil rights movement presented many white people in that era with these contradictions, these cracks in the cosmic egg that a different sense of justice could come through.
And you talk about that contradiction and how it played out even in that moment when the Tuskegee schools were ordered desegregated. You said the community had more or less figured it out.
Right.
And then George Wallace shows up with the state police.
Yeah, he sends that morning when I got up to go to school, he sent 100 state troopers to ring the school, and then later he sent 100 more with Sheriff Jim Clark on horses from Selma. I mean, it was that whole police state of Alabama. So I got up and we couldn't go to school. And so I was lying under these bushes looking at my school, what had been my school, it wouldn't be anymore, with white people's legs and then police legs. And then through that, at one point, I saw these three black kids coming down the steps of the middle school and walking across the breezeway and going up into the high school. And as I've thought about it and wrote about it, it was just my heart went out because I recognized, like, they could be me. There they are in this place I've walked so many times. And why does it take all of this force to keep us apart, you know? So it gave me one of those questions of a lifetime to keep pondering.
Meanwhile, at home, these questions at least don't appear. Your father's asking himself other questions.
Yeah. How to maintain segregation, how to do it in Alabama. He goes to Virginia and Maryland, Virginia, where they've started the first segregated private school movement, and he comes back. He and my mother of two of four parents who start make an academy, and then he organizes private schools in the rest of the state.
So what are you making of all of this? You have this moment when you think that could be me.
Right.
And then here's your father working very actively to preserve segregation.
Right.
What are you making of that?
Well, I'm confused. Like, I believe in states' rights. I think Yankees are hypocrites. But I think segregation's wrong. But I don't contradict my parents. When there were other white people going to Tuskegee High School, which was really a block away from the segregated school. The other kind of pivotal experience I had, though, that gave me material to think about that I would have to kind of percolate on later, I actually had to come out before I could really make sense of that, and I wasn't going to do that at 13. I didn't anyway, some people might. But was in church, my Methodist church that I loved and got taught Sunday school and MYF and Bible school, and just about every time you could go there, I played the piano, and I loved people there, and I loved Jesus. And when I was maybe 13 or 14, I was singing the choir, and it was when the SNCC demonstrators were targeting white churches, I think to show the hypocrisy, but they were coming to pray on the steps when the doors were locked, and my father was one of the door lockers. They called that job the welcomer. The deacons and the ushers who did it became welcomers, which meant they shut people out. And so I'm seeing these stained glass windows to the side of the church, and the one next to the end is Jesus knocking at the door. And I know my Bible verses, and I know that says, knock and it'll be open to you, and seek and you'll find. And so I'm sitting there kind of scratching my head and going back and forth between those, and I know that it's a contradiction. And not so long later, white men beat up those demonstrators when they come with baseball bats. So after that, I was kind of through in my heart with the church, but it took me a while. It took me getting out of Alabama, took me coming out to kind of align myself with what I knew then was the right side of history.
Tell us more about that, about coming out, about coming to North Carolina, going to Duke.
Came to Duke. Duke did not do it. I just want to make that very clear. but I came to Duke to do it.
Because this would have been, give us the year now. We got to set the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I came to Duke in 72. I got a PhD in 79. I was very closeted until late 70s. And then I started doing really electrifying to me lesbian work. Lesbian feminist work with friends who were taking on the South from a materialist way, race, class, gender, sexuality, what it means for us to be lesbians and gay people in the South. Don't go to San Francisco. Don't go to Greenwich Village. Like, stay here and figure it out. By 1983, I was unemployed because I had quit an English job at Campbell University, Southern Baptist School. If they had had a ghoul back then, I would have been fired in about 6 minutes. took me a while to leave. And I started volunteering when an organizer from the National Anti-Klan Network, in conjunction with Leah Wise, who was on their board then and lived in Durham, started getting people together to organize against what information was. North Carolina had the worst Klan and Nazi movements in the United States. So I was a volunteer, very active for a couple years. And then when they got a 501c3 and started North Carolinians Against Racist and Religious Violence, I was asked to be the coordinator. So I did. I really jumped the tracks, and my life took off.
Did that surprise you that North Carolina was the center that had the greatest Klan and
No,
Nazi
I mean, activity? It's 40th anniversary this year of the Greensboro Massacre, and that was shocking.
Just remind us.
Members holding an anti-Klan rally in Greensboro by the Workers' Viewpoint Organization at that point against the Klan, and a caravan of Klan and neo-Nazis drove in with high-powered rifles, got them out, and just started shooting people and shot to death five of their lead organizers there, and were not convicted in either state court of murder or federal court of civil rights.
And they weren't stopped, and there's some pretty good evidence that the police knew and let it all happen. Pretty good evidence.
Yep.
All right, so that's all happening. This is the state of North Carolina. You're here. Talk about this idea of not going to Greenwich Village. Don't go to San Francisco. Stay here in the South and work it out. That takes a lot of courage, it seems to me, and a lot of faith, perhaps.
Well, a lot of people were doing it, too. So you never do something real brave like that. Usually you don't do it by yourself. So,
What was going on, and how do you do that? What's the way to engage that? Because, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether or not you just sort of let them burn themselves out and whether the engagement is the thing that gives them the visibility, all that sort of argument.
I mean, they already had a huge amount of visibility. Glenn Miller of the White Patriot Party was the largest neo-Nazi group in the country. We had the worst Klan groups. All across the state, there were a series of incidents by three different Klan groups that were called by the sheriff isolated incidents or jokes or whatever. So first thing we did is document 135 incidents since Greensboro. And that's a pattern. That's not an isolated incident, and it's not funny to people it's happening to. And then we began to work. There was a North Carolinians NCARV, we called it. Started to work in communities, first in Statesville with our board president, Reverend Wilson Lee, who'd had a cross burn on his lawn, to figure out how to mobilize in this kind of post-Greensboro environment to really alert people this is very serious. This is not a throwback. This is not to be minimized. These are very dangerous groups. And the White Patriot Party was the most dangerous of them. Ended up one of its members had a bunch of guys go in to a Shelby little adult bookstore January 1987 and make the five guys in there lie down, and they shot them all in the head, killed three of them, substantially injured the other two. Turned out to be white patriots wanting to avenge Yahweh on homosexuals. So it was that level of danger with paramilitary organizing, stealing plastic explosives from Fort Bragg. And more, especially as the White Patriot Party targeted police and the Reagan administration, even as a Zionist occupational government, kind of hard to get your head around, really. It converged, and they were taken down.
Well, you know this, I mean, I don't know if I really want to go down this path, but it's not so hard to believe, because ultimately Reagan is the main defender of the primary cause of their pain, which is the globalized economy, a sort of capitalist consumer economy. He's promoting this in a big way, and that's one of the things that they found, you know, sort of as actual nationalists, they saw, hey, wait, this guy's not a nationalist. He's not one of us.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, let's not. I'm sorry. You just triggered that thought. You know, you know how that can happen. But talk about, you said it took coming out for you to be able to really to get mobilized.
Right,
why?
Right.
What was what's going on?
It was this basic part of myself that I couldn't name, and I felt outside of things. I just didn't understand it. It was like being in a fog or something, like you're fighting, but you don't know what you're fighting. And so as soon as I could name myself as a lesbian, among other lesbian feminists in Durham who were remarkable models of living amazing lives that were inverts and perverts and criminals and everything, I mean, it really illuminated for me my own possibilities and really focused me. And then once there, I could go back and identify myself as a lesbian with the civil rights workers, whom I kind of imprinted on. Maybe I was like a little duck and they were geese or swans or something. And so I could do those translations and understand relationships between queer organizing and anti-racist organizing and Jim Crow and all those kind of things.
There has been tension, though, among those groups for a variety of reasons, particularly back then. What did you experience?
We were doing something different. We were bringing together a coalition of people against Nazis whom we knew. Jews knew that. Queer people knew that. Gay people knew that. Black and brown people knew that. And many women knew that, you know, that if Glenn Miller could do what he said he wanted to do, which was put 1,000 white men on the streets of the South to take back the South, we took him seriously. And it was a kind of whack-a-mole in different communities across the United States when there were these upsurges of this kind of neo-Nazi white supremacy and also anti-Semitism. So we took that on.
You talked about, and I want to come back
to, and so to, we had to work together. We had to solidify relationships with each other. And we all recognize, like, the racism within the gay community is detrimental to everything. The homophobia within the African American community gives an avenue for the right wing preachers to come in and distort things. I mean, we all recognized we had a stake in each other's lives and each other's struggles, and so it really became a kind of intersectional organizing that was later kind of Kim Crenshaw in 1989 talks about intersectional feminism, and it was those kinds of working at intersections, I think, that allowed us all to articulate that.
I'm going to follow that thread a little bit later in the conversation to see where we are today and how those persisted and thrived. But I want to take you now back to the personal, because you write this memoir 25 years ago. We talked about the very different ideas you and your parents had, particularly your father. And I want you to talk a little bit more about your mother as well. You took this book back to them.
Yeah.
How did that, talk about that.
Yeah, but there's one more thing that I didn't mention. Like in 1966, my father got a phone call from the jail, and it turned out that a man named Marvin Segrist had killed a man named Sammy Young. And I didn't know who either one of those were, but Marvin Segrist was a distant cousin. My father definitely was close to him. And Sammy Young was a SNCC worker, and Marvin had shot Sammy. And it was the first SNCC worker killed in the struggle. So I have that moment of memory, too. And so there's a lot for me to kind of resurface, like, how am I Sammy and how am I Marvin and as a lesbian and white person, all that kind of stuff. So so you asked me, though, about my mother and
bring it about now.
Yeah. When I started writing, my mother and my father were very central to my writing, trying to figure out my relationship with them. My mother, one of the first things I wrote was on the African-American women who had worked in our families as beloved maids, with all the contradictions and ironies in that, kind of doing an assessment of, like, really, is this love, and what wages were they, and how did we contradict or not white supremacy? I wrote a book called My Mama's Dead Squirrel and gave it to her in galley. She was quite shocked and upset by it. I remember what she said to me is, Mab, I don't have many friends left alive. She was very late in her life. In Tuskegee, you've managed to quote me saying something insulting about every one of them. But generally, yep. Eventually, though, she forgave me because she saw me trying to find my way in the world. With my father, a little earlier, I sent the book to let him know I was writing about it. My mother died soon after my mama's dead squirrel came out, so I didn't want to, like, wipe out my entire parent population. And so my dad called the next week, and I said, well, Daddy, what'd you think? And he said two things. I think it was heartbreaking, and I think you're too hard on yourself. And then he also said, like, I remember different things, but you have the right to your own memories.
Talking to the author of Memoir of a Race Traitor, Mab Segrist, today on The State of Things. Memoir of a Race Traitor, Fighting Racism in the American South. You said that that opened up a dialogue in some ways.
We became friends after that, you know, and he really respected me. I write in the new introduction, like, how lucky I was in my parents that they respected me even when I was contradicting them publicly in very intimate ways about the people in their family they loved. My daddy didn't necessarily love Marvin Segrist, but my mother. But also working to dismantle the world they lived in. And they gave me a kind of blessing for that, even though they really let me know how it made them feel. And their voices really come through this. So I think it's one of the strengths now when things are so polarized within the country, within states, within families, that we kept up with each other and came out of different
So that leads us to the question, where are we today in all of this? Maybe I'll leave it at that, and then we can kind of take it part by part. But these organizations that you were part of in the 80s and through the 90s, you know, sort of what's the trajectory and what's the outlook?
Well, they have really gone to scale. When you have Nazis in the White House, Stephen Miller's a Nazi, Bannon, alt-right, very leader of the alt-right. And when you have somebody who is promoting white nationalism across the globe, when you have somebody is immoral and greedy and unethical in the most powerful position in the world, and when you have somebody now who is threatening the country with civil war if he gets impeached, when he is imminently impeachable, like the civil, any Southerner, I've got three Confederate great-grandfathers, that war killed 800,000 people. And if you want white genocide, you just try that then. And it wasn't the Yankees. It was the slave masters who engineered secession and pulled the whole country into this war. One out of five white men died, three times more than North. So if white people are interested, if white nationalists are interested in eliminating white genocide, they might eliminate white supremacy.
There are other indicators of white genocide as well, in terms of health indicators, gunshot deaths in this country.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about the statistic from Jonathan Metzl's Dying of Whiteness that in Missouri, he charted some of these things. Between 2008 and 2015, the number of years of lost white male life productivity in that amount of time was 10,506.
Yeah.
You know, from suicides.
White-on-white violence.
Or white self-violence or whatever, just having all these guns around. I mean, it's killing white people, too.
Are things turning around?
Well, things are at a crisis point. Yeah. Hegel would call it a struggle to the death of contradictions, but they're heightened contradictions. And this man who has so much power, who is so antithetical to any constitutional principle, any Christian principle. I mean, the Christian principles I learned in my little segregated church were knock and it'll be opened, were suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for such is the kingdom of heaven, were love thy neighbor, and that's the Samaritan who's this lying on the road being beat up. It's harder to get into heaven for a rich man than a camel through the eye of a needle. I mean, those are things that don't guide the prevailing theology today. Not the prevailing one, but the one that's ruling with him too and holding him in place. And we all have to step up, because, you know, it's hard. You can't really overestimate the danger of the moment.
Mab Segrist is author of Memoir of a Race Traitor, Fighting Racism in the American South. She's going to be speaking at the Forest of Duke on Saturday, October 19th at 7 o'clock, and other North Carolina activists will be in conversation on Thursday, October 24th at the Rubenstein Library on Duke's campus, and you can find it all at our website, stateofthings.org. Mab, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about fighting back against the great divide and conquer politics on the State of Things. Stay with us.